Hello and welcome. You're listening to Speaking of Urology, the official podcast for Urology Times. As always, our commitment is to deliver urologists and allied health professionals timely and informative insights from leaders in the specialty. Our exclusive interviews bring expert analysis, practice advice, and policy perspectives to help our listeners practice more efficiently. I'm your host and assistant editor, Hannah Clark. I'm joined today by Dr. Gopal Badlani and Dr. Stephen Kaplan, who will discuss some of the notable abstracts on benign conditions from the recent American Urological Association annual meeting, which was held in Chicago, Illinois.
My name is Gopal Badlani. I'm professor and vice chair of urology at Wake Forest. I'm co-editor of Urology Times and pleased to welcome Dr. Steve Kaplan on this podcast. Steve is professor at Mount Sinai in New York City. He's also the research chair of the AUA. He's an innovator himself and had a new novel session at the AUA 2023 in Chicago called Innovation Nexus. Steve, welcome. And if I may, I'd like to ask your opinion on some of the new innovations presented in the late-breaking abstracts and podium sessions at the Urological Convention. These are focused on urological condition that usually affect quality of life per se. So Steve, tell us a little bit about the Innovation Nexus. What did you intend and did you achieve your goal?
Well, first, thank you, Gopal, for kindly inviting me to be part of this. It was a very busy AUA for sure. So one of the challenges in urology is to really push the envelope forward with discovery. Like any business, and urology is no different. It's really, its future is based on where we're going in the future. And urology as a whole has lagged, and there's multiple metrics of that. So one of the things we wanted to do is to create an environment where innovators, entrepreneurs, doesn't even have to be urologists, but urologists certainly, strategists can all get together and really begin to have conversations with each other about how to push ideas forward. Because if an idea languishes in somebody's head, it doesn't really help. Ultimately, what we all want to do is help our urologic patients. So this is the initial at-bat, if you will, for creating this nexus. This was a meeting that was held the day before AUA, and really it was not the typical grand rounds or AUA meeting. It was really having bankers, innovators, strategics, people who have been successful, even in the urology world, of bringing their ideas to reality. So it actually went even beyond our own expectations. There was tremendous interest. Even today, I've gotten three emails this morning from people who with innovators and trying to connect them. So I think the future looks bright for this. We want to develop a living, breathing entity as opposed to just meeting once a year. We will be having a boot camp sometimes in September to train people how to really create a business plan, how to bring that forward. But we want this to be a sustainable effort, and that's going to take some time. But for our first foray into this, we were very happy.
Is the content accessible for people after the meeting?
Well, at this point, we're trying to create that environment, and that's exactly the point. We want this to be something that is sustainable in the future. There are some recordings of it. I'm not sure at this point if there is a webcast like AUA for it. But what we want to be able to do is have this to be memorialized, as the case may be. And we will also develop a roster of people so people can begin to connect. It's beginning stages and learning and a lot of lessons learned from this as well. But what we hope to do is be able to create a place for people to go. And that's in process.
Wonderful. Let me now shift gears to the late breaking abstracts. One of them was the Pinnacle study, and it was led by you, and you're an investigator for that study. I think an earlier publication on this was from a South American group. This was a randomized study. So tell us about this drug-coated balloon treatment for BPH.
So it's interesting how we're going back to the future. Some of the, and one of the next studies we'll discuss are stents and balloons. And in the 1990s, we thought they, after had a a play in urology that they were gone forever. And here we are, I'm going to be talking about stents and balloons again. But times have changed. Obviously, that was 25 years ago, and balloons have changed. The construction of balloons have changed. Understanding what they do has changed. So this is a drug-eluting balloon using paclitaxel. And the key here is because of the new technologies in balloons, and obviously you're very much in front of a lot of that, is doing an anterior commissurotomy. And basically, when you split the top of the prostate open, that seems to increase efficacy. And what we have found, and there was a number of data points that we presented at AUA, is that compared to sham at a year, there was significant improvement in symptoms. But more importantly, the flow rate, we've never seen flow rates like this before. They almost approach what we see with TURP and laser TURs. So, and this wasn't a one-off, because we found that in our phase two, four-year data, the flow rate improvement, which is almost about 10 milliliters per second, was sustained, and sexual function is maintained. So we're pretty excited about it. Obviously, we'll have to see what happens, gets regulatory approval, hopefully later this year, and what reimbursement will be, because that will drive a lot of the engine. But it's kind of a unique, minimally invasive technology, simply because it stands out with respect to flow rate. In addition, the retreatment rate was pretty low so far, but it's early, but the data looks pretty good.
So as you mentioned, in the 90s, I remember doing these balloon dilations, and we did urodynamic study. And of course, those results were not sustained or proven urodynamically. The difference here is the commissurotomy and the drug that is allowing the healing to be different. Is that?
That's what we think. I mean, it's, you know, people ask me, well, what's the paclitaxel doing? And I mean, there's a lot of theory, and we haven't studied it per se. And I think there are groups who are going to be looking at what the inflammatory response is. I think it mitigates a scarring response, it seems, because when you look inside the prostatic urethra after a number of years, you can still see what seems to be an opening, an anterior commissurotomy. And we know from our own training, when you and I trained, when we did a simple prostatectomy, the first thing we did was to do, in a sense, an anterior commissurotomy. We used to crack the top of the prostate, because that was always the weakest part. So what I try to explain to patients is that the old balloons used to take a channel and make the channel just larger, take a small O or a zero and make it a bigger zero. Here, we're converting a zero or an O into a V at the top, so it splits open. And I think that's why the urodynamic findings are sustainable, which makes it kind of unique.
Have you done any MRIs on these prostates after the balloon to see if there is an anatomical difference?
Well, it's hard to see. It would be hard to see it off the top end of it. I think those are the things we're going to be looking at. And there are groups who are studying, as you mentioned before, the inflammatory pieces of it. And I think it's something we'd like to answer. Because from a mechanistic perspective, why is this happening? But it seems to be happening. And as I said, just visually, we've done that. There have been some MRIs, but I don't think conclusively we can say based on the MRI that a certain process is happening. But from a visual perspective, you look at it and you say, oh, wow, it's really still open from the top. And I think that's...
Yes, I'm very much looking forward to some longer data. As you say, the four-year data would be very welcome. Mm-hmm. I've been through so many of these minimally invasive treatments, as you and I have been.
Yes.
So let's talk about the very new late-breaking abstract on the Zenflow stent, the spring system. This was only a 10-patient study. What's your impression of?
So we, and it's interesting how a number of the companies, they're called stents. So you can see here, it's called the spring, and Zenflow is kind of the first at bat, and they're most fully processed with respect to how far they are along in the regulatory process. They just completed enrollment on their phase three study. And there's another system called Proverum, which we're calling an expander. So there were about 75% through with enrollment there. So I think the concept is that the old stents, the old Urolumes, that was by AMS, had a lot of hardware, a lot of metal in there, and it created anitis for infection and crustacean migration. So some of these newer expander springs have a lot less of it. And what we've learned is something interesting. And certainly when I was involved early, because I was an investigator for the Euroloom years ago, was that we thought that we needed to keep the entire prostatic urethral channel open. And what we learned is that just not necessary. Just keep preventing it perhaps from closing completely is all you need to do. Because obviously the spring or the expander itself is not going to open the entire channel, but it keeps it open enough. And based on at least some of the data here and here with the Zenflow spring device and what we're seeing with first in man studies with some of the other devices, there's an improvement in symptoms. And Euroflow improvement is a little bit more modest, more what we see with the Eurolift and Resume type of systems. We'll have to see. Obviously, long-term data, encrustation, all those types of problems that occurred in the past, we have to kind of keep in mind in the future. But we think because there is less of a metal footprint, that's why I think these things will be successful. The other thing about it is, as you remember from the old stents, you needed a rigid device. And what we're trying to see, and there's an evolution with multiple devices, to use a flexible cystoscope. And that's really, I think, where the market piece of it could be very important, because some of the other devices that are out there today need a rigid scope. And that requires a different type of anesthesia and different type of preparation. Flexible scopes are easy. So devices that can be given through a flexible mechanism, which can take literally minutes, could have an advantage. But ultimately, as we know, you know, we can throw data from today till tomorrow. It will be the reimbursement, the economic data that I think will also have importance with regarding to long-term sustainable use of some of these alternative therapies.
We are currently the iTind. Is another device which is we're currently studying it with a Eurolift comparison randomized trial between the two, because I think currently the missed leader is Eurolift, which has been on the market, and these devices are going to compete in that sphere. Now, iTind has a placement and removal, which is a big controversy, the quote-unquote retreatment. How is that treated? You also lead the Society of BPH, where I feel the buzzword this year was the retreatment and the controversy surrounding it. Any thoughts?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the problem or part of the challenge. And, you know, when I gave this plenary talk on BPH predicting the future, that was one of the highlight pieces of it, or things that I emphasized, is that we need to get uniformity. And what is retreatment? What is a second procedure that's done? And, you know, we always talk about what urologists think, but we forget there's a patient at the end of this. And when they have to come back to the office to get something done, or if they have a procedure done, whether it's a urethral lift or Resume, and they have to go back on a medication, isn't that a retreatment? Is that a treatment success? And the problem is we don't have uniformity. And I think that's kind of the important things that societies like the AUA and other organizations around the world, we should come to a consensus, because ultimately we need to let our patients know what the situation is and what their anticipation is, because managing expectations is important. And frankly, the other piece of the puzzle is payers, because payers are going to look at this and say, well, hold on a second. You know, we do X, Y, and Z, and you get reimbursed for that. But downstream, if in a year or two or 3 years later, you need something else done, does this really make economic sense? One of the things that I think is very clear from real-world data that we presented at AUA and that others have presented in other meetings and have published, clearly in the real world, retreatment rates, and by the most simple definition, a retreatment is you need another BPH procedure. That's simple, is higher than what we thought and higher than it's reported in the literature. And a reason for that is that when you look at real world data, everybody in, everybody out, you know, everybody is analyzed. In regulatory studies with devices, it's only those patients who come in to follow up. So obviously you get the best of the best. What happened to those patients who were lost to follow up? They're not included in the retreatment pool. And I think that's what we're seeing in the real world data. And we have to be aware of that. And just for us as urologists, as we treat, but also importantly for our patients as well. So I think it's an evolution that's occurring, and is hardly a single answer, but I think it's a great place for people to spend some time looking at current data and come up with, I think, widely accepted metrics for what treatment success and failure is.
I think the other thing that patients care a lot about is the catheter and the catheter duration. You know, some of these devices have no catheter, and even though the results are modest, without having a catheter and without drug, a certain advantage to at least a group of patients. Whereas prolonged catheterization, even after a good treatment, is a concern for many patients.
I completely agree. It's sometimes we, as I said before, we look at things from our perspective, but we have to remember that there's what's the patient's perspective, you know, sexual function, ejaculatory function. There was an interesting debate at the Society of Benign Prostate Disease about does it matter? Well, it matters to a bunch of patients, you know, to say that, well, it's not important. Why don't we ask the patients themselves? And I think it's the perspective of defining that. And we just have to be aware of it. And as I said, from my perspective, giving accurate information is really what we should be about. If urologists are going to be the leading people to treat men with lower urinary tract symptoms, be it overactive bladder symptoms or symptoms secondary to BPH, we should give the best data that we can get and be upfront about it. And it's okay. Patients will accept that as long as they know that that's what's coming.
So let's switch gears to perhaps it's not only female, but predominantly female voiding dysfunction with overactive bladder. A lot of new toys and devices related to implantable modulation, neuromodulation. I think the tibial nerve stimulation devices are coming like gangbusters. So at least the Blue Wind had a late-breaking abstract from Dr. Hieskers. We are currently studying the Coloplast device in our institution. And so was there something that interested you, or did you see?
Well, yeah, there was some work that you're doing, and I'm kind of curious from your perspective as we look at various ways, non-medication, because obviously some of the older agents and overactive bladder, or particularly as we use them in patients as they age. So I'm kind of curious in terms of from your perspective, if, as you look at these various types of stimulators, where do you think this is going to land, and where do you see kind of based on this data, and maybe over the next year or two, what people should be looking for?
I think first is to emphasize the guidelines that it's only a tertiary treatment. You know, patients have to go through bladder training and or behavioral modification onto the medications, and then finally choose one of the three tertiary options of Botox neuromodulation in the sacrum and tibial nerve stimulation. I think there were a lot of restrictions related to the neuromodulation in the sacrum with restriction related to MRI, et cetera. They're largely or slowly going away, but that restricted use in a lot of the neuropathic population, the MS and other type of patients that often need MRI were restricted. Also, the older patients were not so keen on this neuromodulation in the sacrum. So the percutaneous tibial nevus stimulation became an option. It seemed easy, but required a weekly return and not easily reimbursed. As you said, that's real world. So the implantable electrode without any battery or anything like that are tiny devices. And then either wearing a sock or an anklet on top charges these have become a way of using it. I think it's in that regard, they're better, but the data is still that 50% of 50%, which is always a concern for me. So if you're wet and you're half wet, is that help? So the blue ribbon, the data good where at least 50% of patients were dry with an average starting point of 4.7 incontinence episode, which was, you know, interesting. And that's what we are finding, at least initially. This is a randomized trial, so, you know, there's just sham control. So we'll find out in a while. But it certainly seems easier. Patients are more accepting of it. But it's, again, waiting that dilemma of the implantable electrode reimbursement and, you know, how that electrode will be. Yeah.
Do you think it's easy to put in? It's going to be widely an easy procedure to do, notwithstanding what the reimbursement will be?
I feel there is a technology, just like, you know, placing the electrode in the sacrum. A lot of people did them in the office, just throwing a wire in. The reimbursement was fantastic, and it didn't do anything. Similarly, this requires an ultrasound guidance. You need to place it appropriately. When I trained on the cadaver, it's illustrative when you, after placing it, you dissect and look where your electrode is. How far away are you from the nerve? It was a humbling experience. There's not as easy as it sounds. So right. There is definitely a learning curve, you know, 5-10 cases before you feel comfortable. So there should be teachers and learners at the same time. You shouldn't launch watching a video.
Right. And that's true for some of the other technologies, as you said, that we talked about. I mean, it's easy to, it's not see one, teach one, do one. You know, and obviously there are varying learning curves for some of this stuff, but I think that will be something to watch in the future as well.
Yeah, with the iTin, when I started doing it, I mean, initially just placing it looked like, and then, you know, switching to the flexible scope and putting it through the sheath became a lot easier on the patient and myself. So it was just a learning. I think with this device, Catherine Matthews at our place is the leader, and she's doing a fair number of these as we are recruiting more females than males, obviously, for this study. I think we should switch to the last bit is on sexual dysfunction. I think Ranjit Ramaswamy from University of Miami, who won the Gold Cystoscope this year, presented an abstract on the PRP, which is heavily advertised in the market in men's health as the next best cure-all. His study showed that really it was no better than a placebo. Did you have a chance to look at that abstract?
Yeah, and I remember, Ranjith was someone who was resident at Cornell, and I've loved watching the arc of his career as he's been involved also with the AWA research initiatives. And it's nice to see physician scientists still around in urology, and I'm very encouraged by folks like him and how they're contributing to the field. You know, you and I have seen patients who come in with various internet advertisements about they're going to take this pill, this cream, this injection, and they'll be, 20 years or 30 years younger. And it just doesn't work that way. And unfortunately, it's kind of like the P.T. Barnum, you know, somebody's there's a sucker born every minute. And unfortunately, it preys on vulnerable people who are looking for some help. And the internet is infiltrated, if you will, with a lot of misinformation. One of the things I looked at back on BPH, there's 11, if you Google BPH, there's 11,900,000 sites, of which 99.7% are treatments. So, and we know in our world, it doesn't actually work that way. So the same thing here, people are looking for ways, particularly with erection, sexual function, trying to be younger. And, you know, there are some interesting things that are out there, but I think it's important to kind of let people know what the real data is. You know, we did a study with Salt Palmetto. Salt Palmetto is a multi-billion dollar business around the world. And the NIH conducted, and we were one of the investigators versus placebo, was no better than placebo. So reality bites sometimes, but I think it's important to do the studies, do them well, and being able to inform people. Now, you and I both know there are people who are still going to use it because that's just the reality of it all. But at least there's some data demonstrating here that it seems to be a lot of more fluff than reality.
I think the position statement from the Sexual Medicine Society is an important one to show, yes, if you want to investigate, these devices fine. It does you no harm was the end of the study, but so does placebo do you no harm. The cost is prohibitive because these men's health clinic charge cash only. The meta-analysis on this, I think there were 11 or 12 studies on this versus six or seven on Peyronie's disease, also where it's been tried. And again, the results are very equivocal. They want to show there is a promise, but there is no data to deliver in this world. I think the shockwave lithotripsy or low energy, which Tom Liu talked about from UC San Francisco, has also been promoted widely outside. And again, the efficacy is questionable in terms of treatment. So I think if patients went to urologyhealth.org, they would get a lot better, truer information than Google, but it's not as widely populated.
Oh,
what
sure.
else? Yeah. What else do you see coming down the pipe in research and innovation in BPH?
Well, I think, you know, like other places, it's there's going to be a shift or an emphasis on artificial intelligence. You know, it's interesting. I looked up when predicting the future of BPH for using ChatGPT version 4, and it didn't really tell me. It was very vanilla. They don't predict, so it was left to me to actually predict. But artificial intelligence is going to be important for data mining, trying to improve actually technologies. And we have to figure out how to harness that. And it's not just for urology, obviously, but there's a lot of push towards that, particularly on the data mining side. I think there's opportunity for us to communicate better. For example, there is a dearth of information for people. You talked about it before with respect to some of the better sources of information through the AUA, Urology Care Foundation, versus the general internet, particularly also for underrepresented minorities and men of color, and I would argue for women of color as well. We need to do a little bit better, and there's some digital apps that are going to be available. Another big area that we're excited about is remote diagnostics, because one thing that we learned with COVID, and it changed a lot, obviously it impacted so many people, but what we learned is that a lot of people would rather do their health business out of the doctor's office. So looking at ways of using wearable devices, and in urology and BPH, uroflows that can be done remotely with transmitting information, I think it's an exciting place to be. And certainly if I were starting my career, that's where I would do my focus, is the remote pieces of it. There are now CPT codes for remote diagnostics. And what we want to do is start working on health assurance and improving that. That rather than treat sick people, let's try to be healthy people and try to get the information earlier, try to have people engage. And frankly, not yours and my generation, Gopal, but the younger generation, they're very into kind of measuring things and measuring themselves. And maybe they can turn to a preventive mode using a lot of these technologies. I spoke with some of the folks at Apple, and you know, obviously we wear these wearable devices. They've told me this is baby stuff. It's nursery school compared to what they have in mind in the future, using remote metrics and sensors to really deliver information about health and being able to do a better job of getting the patients that need to come into the doctor's office to come in there. So it's a really exciting time. You know, just when we thought that things had all settled, and not just for BPH, it's like a renaissance, and technology is going to drive this. And that's why, getting back to your original question about the AUA Innovation Nexus, we want to take ownership and leadership, innovation and technology. We've done a good job with technology with different robots and different those types of things, but not to really improve healthcare access and improve healthcare outcomes. And that's where I think technology has a major role. And there are people interested. I'm very excited by the fact that I've gotten countless calls since the AUA Innovation Nexus launched about how do we connect and how do we do this? So I think the future is actually quite bright. I want urology to be at the forefront of it and to lead.
You just heard an exclusive interview with Dr. Badlani and Dr. Kaplan on some of the notable data that were presented at AUA. Be sure to subscribe to Speaking of Urology on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or other apps. You can get the latest in urology news, practice management advice, and health policy updates by by visiting our website, urologytimes.com, or by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn at Urology Times. Thank you for listening.